Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrn Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. I'm one of those rare people that still visits my public library. And I do that for aesthetic as well as practical reasons. The library is a small building of blocks of reddish maroon stone and looks kind of like a small castle. The main reading room looks like a small grand room, if you'll pardon the oxymoron. The walls are paneled and the ceilings vaulted, and there's soft light that comes through the windows and from the overhead light fixtures that gives the place a mellow glow, so that even the row of computers and other electronic equipment for public use don't look quite so alien. The practical reason why I visit my library is to periodically check out books and also DVDs. The last time I went to the library, one of the DVDs I checked out was the PBS documentary called Seabiscuit. I had heard an interview with the author of the book when it first came out, and I recall my dad referring to Seabiscuit as the working man's horse. But though I went through a horse phase like most young girls did way back when, and when I went on to veterinary school and realized all the danger those animals were facing racing on hard surfaces before the growth plates and their bones had even closed, I became more turned off of the sport than ever. But I decided I wanted to learn more about Seabiscuit anyhow. What made this horse the working man's horse? The documentary was extremely well done. Seabiscuit was kind of a rags-to-riches human-animal bond story in which both the animal and the humans involved figured equally. It was a love story in a way, too. When trainer Tom Smith first bought Seabiscuit, Seabiscuit was on his way out, even though he was still a young horse. He came from good breeding, but he might as well have been called Seabisquick, because apparently his owner was so anxious, so impatient to win back his investment, that he entered the horse in multiple races, and the horse didn't do well. When Smith bought Seabiscuit, his legs were deformed, his gait was horrible, he looked like a broken-down old horse. And then Smith did something that just stuck in my mind, because it showed what an incredible bond this man had with animals, and especially horses. And in fact, one of the people who was interviewed for the documentary, who knew Smith, said that he didn't talk to people that much. He had a difficult time communicating with people. Instead, he would make this noise like, which I know I'm not making very well, but anyone who's been around horses knows that sort of sound that horses make. It's not an aggressive sound. It's just a form of horse communication. And the first thing he did after he bought this horse was to send the horse to his facility and then do nothing but feed the horse the finest food, provide him with grooming and the finest care, and let the horse sleep. How many trainers, how many behaviorists, how many specialists out there, how many of us owners would be willing to give our animals a chance to physically and mentally heal? To sleep as much as they wanted to sleep, and see that as a way of training. We don't. We wouldn't. We're too impatient now. Say, oh, no. Well, if he wants to do that because, he's in pain, well, we'll give him a painkiller. And then, let's see, if we massage him 4 times a day, and then we exercise him, lightly, of course, for just a few minutes, maybe every hour or so, and we'd be in there and we'd be mucking about. But what this horse needed he needed to find out who he was. He was just a baby. And as a baby, he had been pretty much put into slave labor to put pounding pressure on legs that weren't fully developed yet. And just by virtue of loving, supportive care, Smith enabled the horse to mature. And then when he felt the horse was sound, he paired him with another down-and-outer, a jockey by the name of Red Pollard, who had this incredible love of horses, as horses, that Smith recognized immediately. And the story has a happy ending for both horse and humans. He was the people's horse because this all occurred during the Depression. When the working people were down and out, they weren't making that much, and they knew that they could lose their jobs at any time. And they needed hope. And back then, one of the few chances they had to make it big legally was to bet on horses. And so people would flock to the races. And some estimated that Seabiscuit was responsible for the sale of more radios than any other form of entertainment. People wanted to hear. He raced about once a week. And people wanted to hear what he did because he was their horse. So above everything else, to me, Seabiscuit is the story of the power of the human-animal bond. Not only the bond between an extraordinary trainer, an extraordinary jockey, an extraordinary owner in this animal, but also the bond between this animal and a nation. I look around at what's going on in our world today, with our reality shows and our idols and all of that orchestrated, choreographed stuff. And even our sports, our gladiators. And it's all so artificial. There isn't anything out there that captures the heart of the nation as a whole the way this horse did back then. I suppose a lot of people would say, well, that's because we're so much more sophisticated now. But it seems to me that more likely we're just more jaded. We live in an age of bisquicks. They're all around us, all sizes and all shapes. But when times get rough, it's really nice to have the comfort of the real thing.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore, by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.